Welcome Robin Rowe here, who's our speaker today. And many people would know Robin as the president of the Art Deco Club, but hadn't realised he was a football raconteur and author until we actually raised this subject. There's often written sometimes in books that you read that people in Victoria seem to have a secret that they share amongst themselves that no one else in the country does. And that when you get to Melbourne, you know, like, they all seem to have this inner knowledge, which is that they all talk football. So you could live, yeah, you could live in the far east of Victoria in Gippsland, and you could live in the far west in Timbula or whatever, but the two could catch up, and, you know, they could have a half hour talk without ever exchanging names, because, you know, it would run on the discourse of football. And then, you know, a Burmese refugee arrives in Victoria after 2 days and they ask him what football team did he go from. And he says he doesn't know. They look at him blankly as if he was from another planet. When people in New South Wales start talking about rugby. So it's a great history, and I thought certainly reasons are particularly grand in one occasion this year to pass without noting this anniversary. So, thank you,
Robin. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the opportunity to come along today. It is the 150th anniversary of the start of Australian football, so it's good to be talking about it. First of all, I guess my St Kilda cred, my family lived in Irwell Street, my mum and my grandparents lived in Lambeth Place, just down from Zelman Cowan. And the first games of footy I saw were from my pusher at the Junction Oval in the early 50s. Then, when I was old enough to make an informed decision, I flopped clubs. Well, I think that was about 1953, and I think St Kilda probably finished last and Collingwood finished on top, so it was a bit of a no-brainer. Okay, so go back 100 years before that, and talk about Melbourne in the 1850s, and this is the St Kilda flag, and we are in no way promoting unhealthy products here. It just happens to be a cigarette card there. Melbourne in the 1850s, a booming colonial town, particularly after the gold rushes, and so the state boomed in the 50s. 1851, there was a population of 77,000 in Melbourne. A decade later, there's a population of 584,000. So it's a bit of a climb. Most of them came from the UK, and what they brought with them was a love of sports and pastimes, particularly racing and cricket. And it became absolutely critical for the colony of Victoria to be the colony of New South Wales at cricket. And so one of the drivers in the new sport, new game of football, was Tom Wills, a flawed genius, you might call him. We'll have a look at him in a minute. And he was determined to beat New South Wales at almost any means. So he was one of the first of the round arm bowlers, and was forever being told he was throwing the ball. But he got together with a number of members of the Melbourne Cricket Club, William Hammersley, who'd been to Cambridge, Tom Wills himself had been to rugby, Thomas Red Smith, who'd been to Trinity College in Dublin, and J.B. Thompson, who was a journalist, and he'd been to Cambridge. Another bloke called Alex Bruce, and Jerry Bryan, a professional cricketer and publican, and we'll talk about him in a minute. And those school connections are really important, because what they did was they brought together all of the school rules that they'd been used to playing with in England, and because no one school's rules could predominate, and they all thought their school was the true code of football, but out in the colonies, they all got together and put together a group of rules, or a set of rules that actually suited them. And the game had its beginnings in Yarra Park. And what you're going to hear about in the next month or so is the first recorded game of football, Melbourne Grammar School versus Scots College, on the 7th of August 1858. And there'll be a reproduction of it. For those of us who haven't been invited to Beijing as guests of Channel 7, we'll be able to see the recreation of this game. But that's the first recorded game, and as so often happens, and I must thank David for his help here, but also introduce Rob Hess at the back, who's a noted football historian and long-term player with the Men's Home Club just down the road. Long the bay, Rob, you're okay. So what we had with this this new game, or this newly embryonic game, was the schools getting involved, and the headmaster of Melbourne Grammar, Dr. Bromby, was very, very keen for sports to be in the curriculum. Now, those of you who have had anything to do with boarding school will understand that the most critical thing that you can do is wear the little buggers out, right? So they've got no time or no energy for mischief at night, okay? So that was one of the reasons why sport was so important in school curriculums. It was also the era of the muscular Christianity movement or ethos. And the driver of all of this was the rugby school in England, which where a lot of these thoughts got formulated. And of course Tom Wills had been to rugby. But we talk about this as the first recorded game, but there's also reports of other games where St Kilda Grammar was recorded as playing in June of that year, ahead of the August game. St Kilda Grammar had been open for 4 years, and it didn't last much longer than 1858, and was probably usurped by Melbourne Grammar. Melbourne Grammar, of course, down on the corner of the main road and St Kilda Road. And Melbourne Grammar played Scotch in that first game. Scotch had opened in 1851 and had moved to East Melbourne in 1854, just near the site of the MCG. But there was also reports of Melbourne Grammar playing a group of men from St Kilda in 1858. So one of the things that we've learned as football historians is never say anything is absolutely definite about those early years, because as soon as you do, somebody comes up with another report. Although we're certainly getting better and better at it, aren't we, Rob? We don't make the mistakes that some of us used to. Of course, the main debate that you'll hear floating around, of course, is how much involvement there was from Aboriginal tribes in these early games. My view is that there was absolutely none. Certainly there were Aboriginal tribes playing forms of games out in the country, and certainly they took on the game later on, but from my view is that the earliest rules were derived from the English schools by a group of people who, except for Wills, had probably never encountered an Aboriginal, and in the racist attitudes of the time would have regarded them as probably, with disdain is just a nice way of putting it, probably a little above the level of animals in those days, according to some of the texts you read. Now, that's not a nice thing for us to confront these days, but that's probably the way it was in those days. Anyway, now, these blokes all got together over in Yarra Park, just across the road from, or just at the back of the MCG, and when they finished playing, they did what every group of footballers has done ever since. They went to the pub. Okay, and this is the Parade Hotel in Wellington Parade, and turned into the MCG Hotel, and it's been reworked and reworked over the years. But they sat down in the pub after a game and started to think about what sort of rules did they want, because, you know, they were obviously going to be playing a number of games, and everybody wanted to play by their own rules, but they needed to have a simple set of rules that everybody could understand. Even the Irish regiments that were coming into Melbourne on the way to the Maori Wars in New Zealand, they wanted the rules to be so simple that even an Irishman could understand them. So, the Parade Hotel was, so you can see down the side, on one side there, there was a lot of bluestone in there, and as I said, got remodeled and it's been reworked over the years. The key driver, or one of the key drivers in this group, and there was a group and that's important, was Tom Wills. Now, Tom was a flawed genius, terrific cricketer, great cricketer, good footballer, and was secretary of the MC, the Melbourne Cricket Club, for a while. Hopeless correspondent, couldn't get himself organised, and when he left, under a cloud, they found all of the papers, etc., etc., and a couple of cigar butts in a big iron trunk, and that was Tom's contribution to office management in those days. Followed in the trunk, yes. He certainly drove a lot of things that were happening. And this is his group of friends. That's Tom on the left there, and right next door to him is Jerry Bryant, and he was the publican at the Parade Hotel. And of course, he did pretty well, because as the links with the MCG became greater, he had the contracts for supplying the MCG with food and liquor, etc. So he did pretty well. He was a professional cricketer in those days. So he was actually employed by the MCC to bowl to the gentlemen at the MCC. And there was a very, very strict division in those days between gentlemen and players. Okay. Now, the game started off, as I said, an amalgam of those from various English public schools: Rugby, Harrow, Eton, Winchester, Shrewsbury, Charterhouse. And the 10 rules that they came up with are believed to be the first written rules of any code in football in the world. What they didn't want was aspects of the games in England. That they had hated when they were students, like being able to kick somebody in the shin, hacking, as they called it. They didn't want to be able to throw the ball. They didn't want to have offside. And offside is very difficult to enforce when you've got gum trees in the middle of the field and no umpires, so I don't know how they thought that was going to happen. So they produced a set of quite simple rules. The offside one was interesting because they didn't, in saying that they didn't want offside, what that meant was that a player could be free on the forward line to get the ball and kick a goal. And in lots of ways, they regarded this as sneaking, as unmanly, to be able to get the ball like that. However, it's probably the greatest thing that was never codified in a set of rules. You think about the problems that they still have with soccer games compared to the free scoring of Australian football. So there we are, at the end of the first year. There's a number of groups. There's the Melbourne Cricket Club, there's South Yarra, and there's St Kilda, all involved in the early development of the game. And soon there were other clubs. Geelong University came into being, and it's a bit hard to know who was playing who, or what was actually going on. There are some reports in the early papers, but it certainly wasn't all that clear. The main grounds, of course, were Yarra Park and Royal Park, and the reason they were played was because everybody could walk there. Most people still live in the confines of the city, and so they could just walk to those grounds or get a cab. They were the most popular areas. To get to South Yarra was a bit of a trip, and you had to go across the punt. To get down to St Kilda was quite a trip in those days as well. You know, the 4 miles was quite a way, and the roads weren't very well particularly made. But by 1859, St Kilda Road had been made, and the railway had arrived in St Kilda in 1857. So that year, St Kilda had bowling, archery, cricket clubs, and it was also reported that they were playing matches against University. The University was an interesting club because there were they had a sort of a senior team at a stage where they had about 400 students or even less, I think. So that ethos of muscular Christianity and fitting in sports into the image of an overall well-rounded student was very strong in the University in those days. And in lots of ways, the parallels, there are lots of parallels between University and St Kilda over the years. And St Kilda played University, and they won 2-1. Now, in those days, the scoring was 2 out of 3. Okay, so the first team to kick 2 won the game. Wasn't a good result if you'd travelled a long way to play a strong team, and they kicked 2 in the first 5 minutes. And people in Geelong weren't particularly happy about that at all. Eventually they decided, they put their thinking hats on and said, well, why don't we make it that the team at the, that's in front at the end of an allotted time is the winner? And they said, oh, isn't that a wonderful thing? So they did that. The crowd contained a good sprinkling of the fair sex, was the way it was described in those days. And that's generally the way that women were described in those days. But what it really meant was there were lots of women turned up to see their friends and their brothers and boyfriends and family members play. Because in the early days, players just played for themselves. They played for the fun of it. Okay? And family came along to watch it. And they didn't particularly care where they played for. They played for one club 1 week and another club the next week. As long as they had a game. And so winning wasn't all that important. Getting out and having a kick was. But this became important later on, the role of women at the grounds, because it became a socially approved setting where you could actually meet young men. And there weren't too many when you think about it. A lot of them didn't go to school for very long. Church was one place that you could meet blokes, but the footy was another place. And Rob Hess has written extensively on the input of women into football over the years. Okay, now the match reports also said that there was had been a club in St Kilda since 1858, but very difficult to work out what was a club in those days. Was a loose collection of friends a club, or did a club have to have written down constitutions, etc., etc.? Okay. Now, what happened also in those early years was the rules kept evolving, and the bloke that ended up rewriting the rules was H.C.A. Harrison. Now, he was he played for Melbourne. Very good looking bloke, isn't he, girls? Steely blue eyes. A pillar of society. A registrar of titles and had been prominent in the customs department. When he got onto the field, he turned into an animal. It's called white line fever, I think. And of course, in those days, if you were aggrieved that something had happened in a match, you'd write a letter to the paper. So Harrison was always writing and responding to letters in the paper about things that he'd done on the field. He loved nothing more than a rough and tough match. So he loved playing against the police and the Irish. And the other clubs that were really, really rough. So the rules were evolving. One of the things that was happening, of course, was that there was now a call for umpires to be introduced. Not only that, but. The skills of the players were increasing as well. It was a pretty much a low-level game. It was like rugby in lots of ways. Lots of packs, lots of in there fighting and eventually tossing the ball out. And if somebody got the ball and kicked it, then there was a rush off to try and mark it. If you marked it, you would mark the spot on the ground, and that was a call that came from one of the English school games. The grounds were still very, very rough. This is the Melbourne football ground. Now, the MCC wouldn't allow them to play on the MCG proper for a long time, up until the mid-1870s, I think, although there'd been some games during the 60s. But they were scared of what they would do to the hallowed turf. So they forced them to play outside on the Melbourne football ground, which is just to the north of the cricket ground. And what they used to do in those days was they'd play on whatever shaped ground they could get, and often they were quite small and square, although this one's, I don't know what sort of, it's almost a trapezoid, isn't it? I wouldn't like your chances of getting a kick down in the forward pocket. down there. But it just shows that before they started to occupy the cricket grounds with football, these are the sorts of grounds that they used to play on. And the surfaces were swampy. There were rocks and mud holes and slopes and gullies and trees and tree roots. However, in 1864, the St Kilda ground was recognised by Free Kick in Bell's Life in Victoria as the best in the colony. And it was located on the side of the St Kilda Railway, opposite the South Park gates, or on the opposite side of the railway facing the bay. There's a space that used to be occupied by alpacas, according to the St Kilda history. Alpacas, yeah. So I don't know what happened to the alpacas, but I mean Victoria had a lot of interesting industries in those days. I mean the Punt Road Hill was a vineyard for a long, long time. So it's not unusual to have a pack of alpacas, I guess. That was 1864. They said that, but there was little evidence that St Kilda actually played there for the next few years. Anyway, what happened with clubs in those days is they would be strong one year, and then a few players would leave, and so they'd drop back to from one year they'd be a senior club, and the next year they'd drop back to being a junior club. Then a few more players would come in, and they'd build back up again. So there's a constant ebb and flow in the fortunes of lots of football clubs. Particularly the clubs that didn't have large packs of supporters in rows and rows of parapets like they have in the inner suburbs, where you know you had a guaranteed source of supporters. So St Kilda was always a little bit spread out, of course. Anyway, St Kilda was the ground was used for other matches though, even though the Saints weren't playing there. Although there was one match between Carlton and South Yarra that had to be played elsewhere because the ground had a drain cut through the middle of it. It was a very wet winter, that one, though. The major problem in those days was in crowd encroachment, where the crowd would run onto the ground. And this was particularly bad out at Carlton, because Melbourne and Carlton were pulling crowds of 5,000 to 10,000 people in those days, and the grounds weren't. They put up a rope to try and keep them out. And so, you know, crowds would encroach on the ground. Not the good people of St Kilda, I'm sure they didn't do that. It was those animals from Carlton. And of course, that led to the major issue in football when the game started was whether you could pick the ball up and run with it. And that got resolved as having to bounce it. But a few years later, when the crowds were encroaching, the major issue was it a goal if it came off a spectator after a play? Okay. Now, South Yarra have been a major club, but they disbanded just after their captain died, unfortunately, and a number of players joined St Kilda, 1873. So the Saints were back up again. They were rising again. And most of them lived in the district, and they became reasonably strong there for a little while. And that's an image of the Junction Oval in 1874. So like all the other grounds in those days, things were pretty rudimentary in the 1860s up until the 1880s. I don't know.
No,
want to tell us the story?
No, that's not the question. Well, there's just one major red gum left in that area, which is the Robbery Road and Junction. But I think what that picture shows, there were many red gums at the time.
Yeah.
In the red gum forest. So, yeah, this one would remain pretty
recognised. Okay. Now, this is how the game looked in those years. This is around about 1870. And you'll see this bloke in the middle here. He's the field umpire. Okay. So they originally started off with a goal umpire each club would nominate, and then they introduced the field umpire. And he was supposed to keep an eye on what was going on. You see these blokes, they're all throwing elbows, there's a couple being flattened, someone's waiting for the ball to come out, one's had his hat knocked off. And as you can imagine, the umpires didn't move too much. They tended to stay in the middle of the ground. But within a few years, they realised that they had to dress more appropriately. They had to do a lot more running, particularly as the game got faster and the ball was being moved a lot more quickly. The umpires had to keep up. And there were no boundary umpires. So the central umpire's role also included throwing the ball in. Now, you can imagine, he's on the boundary line, throwing the ball in with his back turned to the play. They weren't allowed to touch the ball until it had actually hit the ground. So of course they just stood there like this and just waited for the ball, didn't they? Yeah, like hell. It was a very rough and rugged event. And there was no bounce of the ball at the start of the game. So they didn't need to be tall, but most of them were very, very solid. And so the tallest bloke was probably about 6 foot in those days. They actually started the game like rugby games, lined up in rows and somebody kicked off and then it came back. So they were heavyweights in those days rather than tall. This is also the time when the late premiership came into being. Now, the late premiership was between St Kilda and South Melbourne. And this was a very, very important fixture. Even when the Saints weren't doing well in the overall competition, it was very, very important to knock South Melbourne off, okay, and vice versa. So that late premiership was well and truly ingrained into the psyche of the people around here, and I'm sure that it was talked about in your families. I heard you talking before about...
No, I've been coming to that.
Oh, right, okay.
Wasn't
fair
anything at all.
Right, okay. Now, that was one rivalry. All of the other neighbouring suburbs who also generated their own teams had their own rivalries, of course. Mm. So you tended to hate your neighbours, okay? So Carlton and North would fight. Port and South would fight. Footscray and Geelong were big, although they weren't immediate neighbours, but they were big rivals. And of course when Collingwood and Fitzroy came along, they were massive rivals. So we hear about the rivalries today of some of these clubs, but a lot of this is can be traced right back to more than 100 years ago. And St Kilda in its early years scored an unlikely win over Albert Park at the Albert Park ground because they were quite a strong team. And the St Kilda players were booed and pelted by the Albert Park Larrikins after the game. Now, pelted means picking up pieces of stone from the side of the road. And there were rules about pelting. It started off that you would only pelt the opposition if they won. But after a while, things society degraded and some of those larrikins were pelting everybody. So the term barrackers probably came from South Melbourne. There's a suggestion that it's an Aboriginal word. There's also a suggestion that the barracks in St Kilda Road gave rise to the term barracker. And it became associated with bad behaviour at football grounds. So there were larrikins and there were barrackers and there were gangs that went to various grounds and kept respectable people away. And eventually it got so much out of hand that one commentator said, nothing short of hanging will eradicate them. A bit extreme, but I'm sure a lot of people subscribe to that theory. Pretty much the way that we see skateboarders these days, I guess. And the other thing that happened in those days, we mentioned the railways before, the railways had become very important in the development of football around the state. So wherever the rail line was extended to a town, generally there would be matches arranged between people in the town, firstly between them and the railway workers, and then against other lines down the town, other towns down the line. And so we talk about neighbouring rivalries in the city, but the rivalries in the country became just as intense, and they were usually against the next town down the line. And they're still pretty intense up in the bush. But what they would do would be invite a city club to come up and play them, and then take them to the pub, okay, and try and get them full before the game started. Now that was pretty onerous on the finances of country clubs, though. But the same thing happened with Geelong, and when St Kilda went down to Geelong in 1874, they arrived at the Pivot, as it was called by them. By midday, were regaled with refreshments and eventually were ready to play at 3 o'clock. So must have been a pretty good lunch. But St Kilda obliged when Geelong came back that year, took them off to the George Hotel, which is adjacent to the playing ground, and did the same thing. The only trouble was that the game was then delayed because the bloke responsible for putting up the goalpost was at the lunch and they forgot to put up the goalpost. So, didn't take them long to sort it out. Now in those days, St Kilda wore red, white and black, and they were the German imperial colours, and we'll talk about that. The colours become quite important when World War I breaks out. 1875, they were having trouble fielding a team, and they merged with University, who were also having the same problem. St Kilda had a long I missed one there. So we'll get to that in a minute. St Kilda had a long history of not turning up players. They were pretty casual about the game, and if they wanted to, they turned up. If they didn't, that was okay. One year, some of them claimed that they got on the wrong train to get to the ground. The trouble was the one they got onto was going to Flemington. There just happened to be races on that day. This has been a recurring pattern, I guess, probably up until the 1980s with the disco down at St Kilda was regarded as the social place to be, even when they weren't doing well on the field. Okay, so they merged with the university, but that was disastrous. Then they went it alone. 1877 was a pivotal year because that's when the VFA was Victorian Football Association was introduced, and that introduced some structure into the game. Now St Kilda was an important part of that, but it also meant that clubs were playing on cricket grounds. Okay, so they moved away from those funny shaped square grounds and they're playing on a whole cricket ground. So that meant that they had a lot more space to play on. It also meant that the umpires had to move more quickly. But perhaps the most important thing was that they could charge admission to get in. And as I said before, women were important at the football, and this just shows some of them going off to the football match. This is probably at Melbourne, because I think that's the governor's house at the back there. They didn't all dress up like that to go to the footy. So 1879, St Kilda was reported as nearly dead, and that came about after no players turned up for one match. So they retired from the VFA and played as a junior club, and then built themselves up again. And they played other junior teams, including one called Southern that played at Faulkner Park and opposite the Alfred. And Faulkner Park wasn't a particularly healthy place to play because they ploughed all the night soil from the district in. So I don't know why they just didn't pop down the river like every other couple, but there you go. And of course that was pretty dangerous if you got tetanus or something like that, playing on the ground like that. Faulkner Park is special though, because it's one of the few structures around, and I had to work out how to get the Art Deco into this. It's one of the few structures around that's actually got free of footballers on the pavilions in the park. So St Kilda returned to the VFA in 1866, and they were now playing at the Junction Oval, and the home of St Kilda Cricket Club. So as I said before, that enabled them to charge admission, and that's how a lot of clubs built up their funds, were able to pay for grandstands. And this is really the start of professionalism, because there was a cycle. You'd commission a grandstand, you had to borrow money to pay for it, to pay it off. you have to have revenue coming in. To have revenue coming in, you have to be winning on the field. To win on the field, you have to pay your players. And so it went. And you know, they talk about professionalism today. My view is it started way back then when they first started building grandstands.
Mm.
Okay. And this is just one of the early players. I've got up there captain. I don't think he was a captain. He may have been. But skinny little stripes on the jumper there. We'll talk a little bit more about the jumper in a minute. And
I'm the three box shirt.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Was
it?
Yeah, I think
he's better than
Ballarat.
Alright, so you've got a long association with Ballarat as well.
Yes,
all right.
I think he's related to Tony
Lockett. Oh, really?
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah,
and this is a fine group of captains from the 1880s, and there's the Saints captain there. Skinny little red, white, and black stripes. A lot of the others, that's Carlton, Heffernan, of course, Geelong.
Which is Collingwood?
Great. Collingwood's not there because it's the 1880s.
Port Melbourne.
Sorry. Which one's Port Melbourne?
The guy sitting in the front.
Him?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. There's always one. Now, Collingwood didn't kick off until 1892, so they're the young pups. So we talk about we talked a little bit more about a bit before about Albert Park and South Melbourne. So this is just the entry to the Albert Park from Clarendon Street. So those gates are still there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways that hasn't changed much, but of course you've now got a massive swimming centre up there. It was very difficult to win at Albert at South Melbourne because the wind would come straight up from the bay and blow about 100 miles an hour along the edges. And this is a bad photo of the late premiership. But it shows us a few things. It shows us an umpire actually able to run in some loose clothes. It also shows us the players are sort of paired off instead of just in a pack. Like they were in those early games. Now, crowds at the football always interesting in those days. And crowds, they had enormous crowds in some of the games. You think about South Melbourne used to pull a crowd of say something like 30,000 people in the late 1880s when Victoria had a population of, well, Melbourne had a population of about 500,000 at that stage. It's just an extraordinary crowd.
Mm.
And people would actually wear reasonably good clothes to the footy, except that Dad looks like a bit of a southwest, doesn't he? But all the ladies would be wearing their hats. Of course, a lady wouldn't have gone out of the house without a hat in those days. Lots of blokes smoking in the crowd, which must have been fun in a packed in crowd like that. And kids always down on the picket fence. So kids worked out how to weasel their way through the crowd to get down to the fence. Getting down there was one thing, getting out was an entirely different thing.
Are they all standing?
No, the front row. The front. Yeah, what they used to have was a couple of rows of wooden seats around the edge. So ladies could sit there or kids could sit there. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the image of St Kilda supporters was always one of aristocratic, well-heeled, with many Jewish supporters, and they were sort of perceptions of the area in itself. And this shows the view of Ginger Steed. Now, Ginger Steed was a larrikin barracker who also wrote for a scarlet rag called the Bullamp. And most of the reporting in those days was by middle class journalists, and they were very, very fond of quoting Shakespeare slabs of poetry to describe the game or describing it in military metaphors, about stout, sterling full of pluck, leading the charge, etc. Ginger Steve had no such pretensions. He was a larrikin. He disliked authorities. He disliked weak-chinned English governors. So he particularly disliked St Kilda supporters. And he referred to them as St Kilda Gutty.
And he's drawn up his view of the St Kilda supporters, even down to the spats on the bare feet. He's got the walking stick and he's got the frock coat and the top hat. But he was very scathing about them. In his view, they were mostly named Reuben or Adolphus, and all of them kind of disgusting names out of the sentimental stage dramas, which they weren't, of course, but it suited Steve's prejudices. And don't forget, this was an era where it was okay to have anti-Semitic sentiments, and the Bulletin was full of them, for example. So this was quite okay in those days. Mind you, we only lasted a year at the paper, and it didn't last much longer itself.
Can we know who Ginger Steve was?
No, no. There were three journalists in the Bullet. There was Ginger Steve, there was Toby Twist, and there was Silas Snell. I suspect the same bloke. he hasn't passed into journalistic history. But according to Steve, it was usual to barrack against St Kilda as follows. Well played, Percy. Pass it on to 30. Good shot, Adolphus. Mind your eyeglass, Horace, dear boy. Play like Reuben, or you may be carried home to your ma in a bucket. And he wrote all this down. So this was the time where St Kilda had merged with Curran to enter the VFA, I think it was 1888. So they weren't doing particularly well around this time. And then the big bombshell hit the world of football with the formation of the VFL, Victorian Football League, 1896. And that was all about money, because the VFA administration wanted to equalise all of the gate receipts, and the powerful rich clubs didn't like that arrangement. They wanted to be able to maximise their revenue, so they broke away. And that was, there were six teams that broke away, Collingwood, Essendon, Geelong, Melbourne, Fitzroy, South Melbourne, and they invited two other clubs to join them. One was Carlton, even though Carlton wasn't going very, very well, so they were invited to join. Somebody's got a lot to answer for there. And the other one that was invited was St Kilda, even though they hadn't been playing very well. But they did have a beautiful ground at the Junction Oval, well served by transport, and they were on the south side of the city. So there were lots of good reasons to have the Saints involved. The only thing was that they didn't win a match for the first 48 matches in their career in the VFL. 1898-99, the St Kilda ground was actually used by the league to host finals matches, and it had a cycle track around it, which didn't do you much good if you landed on it. And we can see here the cycle track still around the edge of the ground. Okay, so this is the new century. And this is footy as it was played at the start of the 20th century. And we see some changes there. The picket fence is holding back the crowd. There's no encroachment. The players are obviously on the run, so it wasn't the static game that it used to be. There's the ball, by the way. And it was a well-organised, well-ordered game compared to the early years. And the centre of St Kilda, of course, was the Junction. Okay, that was where everything went on, and High Street was probably a lot more prominent than it is today. I think Fitzroy Street is probably the main social centre these days. And here we have the cable car going down St Kilda Road there. So 1906, buildings were starting to creep up the sky a little bit, and because the club then had all the clubs had their own theme songs. St Kilda's was
It was a song, it was a musical song from England. I think it was about 1909. It was popular in English seaside towns such as Brighton. I found it on a website about England's best beaches. Can you believe that? Not a very big site. And those are the words. I do love the beach side, the seaside. I do love the beach side, the sea. Down at the junction, there's a football ground, and that's where the Saints all hang around. So let's give 3 cheers for Old St Kilda, for this year the Premiers they may be. Though it's not yet in the bag, we've got hopes of winning the flag, beside the seaside, beside the sea. So they're quite respectful. They say that they've got hopes of winning the flag. And you compare that to Collingwood, who said, oh, the Premiership's a cakewalk. So they were quite a modest club with their pretensions. Of course, when they moved to Moorabbin in 1965, they were no longer near the sea, so this was irrelevant. So they changed it to when the Saints came marching in.
It wasn't
until then. That's right.
Really?
Yeah. Yes.
We actually were called, I think,
the Eagles. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is the Saints in 1907 having a half-time break. Some of them sitting down, the rest of them standing around. Probably some of them having a fag, as they used to do at half-time in those days.
I've got a
long
and pair of shorts, and I
wish
I could guarantee.
Oh, yeah.
And the relatives that got it in were saying that
Okay, so this is some of the Saints in action from those days. We talked about Guernsey. This is Vic Cumberland, one of the champions of the country. Jumpers with a roll neck. Now imagine playing footy in a roll neck. But the other style of jumpers we had was this one, which was a lace-up. And these were often chamois. Made of chamois, and they were very, very hard to grab hold of, particularly in the wet. Only trouble was with the lace-ups is they stopped using them when a couple of players got their fingers caught in the laces and had their fingers torn off. And this is St Kilda players against Fitzroy. I think this is probably 1904. These are all off cigarette cards, of course. And we see the jumper, and we'll have a look at Georgie's jumper page soon, I'll be interested to see that. The stripes have got a bit bigger than they were before. They were those very, very skinny stripes before. The other thing to look at, of course, on our friend on the left there is the big, heavy boots.
Yeah.
You see some of the ones players wear today, they're like slippers compared to them. Yeah. Okay, and then this is the chains that they had. And this came about in the First World War because they were the colours of Germany, so they swapped over to the colours of Belgium, red, yellow and black. And that may be a myth because the colours of St Kilda Cricket Club had traditionally been red, yellow and black. So whether they moved because of the war or not, is up the grass. And that's what they look like in their new jumpers. Pretty dull, aren't they? Or they look dull there.
One of our heritage jumpers is
Jumpers
Cricket Club. We just had one day that they
made
yellow and black.
Oh, good. Good. They moved back to the red, yellow and black. This is a gentleman called Arthur, and you can see the difference in the shape of the player. I think he was a ruckman, long skinny legs, so in those days it had become a lot more important to be tall rather than heavy. Now the other thing we talked about before was grandstands, and this is an image of the Junction Oval grandstand, which I think was built in the 1920s and may have been extended in the 30s. Most of the grandstands were actually built in the 19th century down there, but I don't think St Kilda could afford one
for quite a long time, and the council wouldn't put the money up. Do you know anything about the
mid-20s?
Yeah.
I think there's a team photo with a half construction sign in the background.
Right, okay. And that's where that was the location of the ground in the 1940s, within the district. And we can see the junction is still pretty low level. So Dandenong Road must be up here somewhere.
Right at the junction.
Right at the junction.
Yeah,
then, was it?
Straight up.
All right. Okay. And we see, there was a big embankment up. Around the ground, and that was pretty common in those days. Tennis courts, one small grandstand, and later on there were a couple of smaller ones built there. So they could actually get in those days, they could actually get a crowd of say 50,000 crammed into one of these suburban grounds, because they'd all be up on those embankments. There was no idea of seeing theatre goers in those days. Or sitting down, no, you went to the footy, to stand at the footy.
You can actually see the corroboree tree there.
Which is where?
Over further near St Kilda Road. Right over. Yep. Over the bigger tree.
Right.
That would be the corroboree. Now you've gone too far. That would be it.
Alright, okay. Yeah.
Right,
okay. So they certainly took out a large chunk of the suburb, didn't they, when they extended. Right.
Because it's right past the junction. So you had the
three streets
before.
Yep.
The building
at right
the front,
Dandenong
Road goes up there,
and you've got
the other
cruise trail. Okay. A very privileged situated ground in those days. And very well drained, so the St Kilda ground forever has been regarded as sort of the best drained ground in Victoria. So it could rain everywhere else and there'd be pools of water, but the St Kilda ground would have drained off quite quickly. I would say anything about them watering the ground when they got the Moorabbin, I promise. Okay, and this stage, the junction itself had changed quite dramatically from those previous shots. So it was a suburb that embraced its football club for better or for worse. It had its shares of ups and downs over the years, and it certainly had their share of internal fights and bickering. Some of them around, as always in footy clubs, ego and money and control. And they certainly had their own ethos about how the game was played. They certainly broke their supporters' hearts many times over the years. But I think it's one of those things that tends to bind suburbs together sometimes, is about how the club's going. And it certainly gives you something to talk to your neighbours and your friends about on a regular basis. And then we get up to... We'll stop there, I think. But this is how we looked at some of those earlier jumpers. This is how we ended up in 1968. Neil Roberts certainly is sort of the epitome of the bronzed football star, bronzed Aussie football star, if you like. Just one thing to note, Sylvie, you might be able to confirm this. They've now got a little badge on their jumper.
10435.
Sorry?
10435.
34.
It was the
human and the boys. Okay. Didn't it come about after one particular game where they finished with 15 men or something like that?
And you could have been
allowed. Yeah. Right. Okay. So that was a proud moment in the club's history. Oh, and Jack Dyke said they would have been playing with bases all over them at Richmond. But there you go. He could say that. He
probably would have spent most of his time in the sideline,
hadn't
he?
Yeah, he would, wouldn't he?
He taught his head at school.
Did he?
He taught at his
Special
school.
Okay.
He was very good with his heritage museum as well. He did the official open for it. and she keeps involved with it, and we also keep in touch with a lot of the older players.
That's terrific.
Past players, former players.
Yeah. And of course his son went on to play a lot of games with St Kilda as well, Michael Roberts. So there we are.
We've actually got one of his jumpers, possibly that jumper, on the wall.
There's a lot of white in that outfit, and the amount of white has varied over the years, of course. They've sort of moved away from that one a little bit, but that happens. So there we are. That's a snapshot of how the club sort of evolved and how it fitted into the local society and some of the perceptions about it from various people. Georgie's kindly brought along all this memorabilia here, so please have a look at that. I'm sure you'd be interested in that. So are there any questions? Anything anybody wants to ask? Good question. Yeah. And that was one of the reasons why St Kilda was regarded as or didn't do particularly well for many years, because they had not an amateur ethos, but they were slow to try and acquire players by paying them, whereas the more powerful clubs used to pay their players either through jobs or through direct payment. And St Kilda often didn't do that, so they missed out on players.
Even in the
19th century in particular. Yeah. Now you had an ethos in the game where presidents would stand up and put their hand over the heart and say, oh no, we don't pay our players. And the secretary was out the back signing blokes up and handing over money. So it was a very, very strong part of the game to pay the players in those days. And players would some players would not make up their mind who they were going to play with until the week before the season started, waiting for the next biggest offer to come in. So it was a very, very powerful part of the game.
So when did it come that they all got paid?
Well,
I didn't start going until 1960, and they weren't getting much money.
No, but they were getting paid.
Getting paid, and also a lot of them. Lived, you know, if you wanted to play for St Kilda, you had to live in St Kilda.
Yeah, well, a lot of them did live locally.
You couldn't live on, they only played once a week.
They were officially allowed to be paid from 1910 onwards.
Oh, right.
So up until then, it was all under the table.
Well, I know when I first started.
But of course, there were limits on how much they could be paid, and of course, rich patrons would pay them extra, along the way. So it's always been a major part of the game.
Yeah, we'll see what they get now.
Yeah.
I wanted to know why it's called a Guernsey, and like a Jersey from Jersey, the island, jumper.
Yeah.
And where does the word Guernsey?
Well,
does
probably
it come from the island.
Oh, Guernsey, I assume. Yeah.
But it would be cold there. I didn't imagine there was. Like, why are they no trees?
That's quite peculiar to this Australian game, where they put the sleeves out. And you see today it's very unusual for a player to have sleeves, but in those days, in the early days, most of them did. And I think it was mainly the 1920s where they started to take the sleeves out. And I don't know why, whether it gave them more.
Well,
more
child, though, wasn't
yeah, yeah, originally they were. I don't know whether, Jersey and Guernsey are almost interchangeable. You see the jumpers described as both. Although probably Guernsey has more currency than Jersey. And I don't know if that's because they got most of their supplies from there or what.
That's
what
you think could be related a bit to the Jackie House English.
Yeah.
The early singlets had sleeves in and they tore them out.
Right.
And the Jackie House singlet was the first one without them to give them more movement.
More freedom.
So that could be a bit related to that. Mm. But do you know anything about the old Scotch College Oval? Was that from when the Scotch College was up near Parliament?
That's the one just near the MCG now.
Yeah. Do you know anything about the history of that?
Not a lot. Rob, did that?
No, I can't help
it. Yeah, I know. I know it's been there. Scotch College moved to Lansdowne Street, now near...
Before or after the Parliament House?
No, well, up near Parliament House, Lansdowne Street, they moved down, they were near Parliament House, then they moved to Lansdowne Street in East Melbourne. So whether they picked up that Scotch College Oval at that stage, because there was a fair bit of open space around, there was East Melbourne Ground and the MCG, but probably that was the nearest space that they could call their own.
But that wasn't where the original Scotch and Melbourne Ground
was? No, that was in Yarra Park, that was north of the stand, the new stand there. So you'll see that in the next couple of weeks when the game is replayed. Hopefully they'll play it in the same spot.
Just from the recap, a couple of things. One is the Shield went on the Rugby jumper in 1934.
Yeah.
And when did the St Kilda Football Club start?
1873.
Thank you.
Yeah. Rob?
Was the move to Moorabbin and Georgie, that might help you, met with much resistance?
Initially, but I think the cricket club at the junction had quite a bit to
say that. Saying moving them out?
Yes. Financially and things like that, what you're talking about then. Yeah. And I've just heard, people were a bit weary of it because it was like moving to Geelong for something.
Yeah. A fair way. But I think
they lost me.
Yeah, but then when you have a look at what happened in the first couple of years, you could only say it was an outstanding success. Because they picked up all of those southern.
Well, that's all the people that couldn't go to football before.
And it was also an era where a lot of people were driving, so the driving was pretty in the children.
That's right.
Yeah.
Plus the Moorabbin Rowers.
Yeah, that's right.
Talking about the ground, Club moving to Moorabbin, at that time, I lived in the Pierre Highway, just where the 64 train joins the highway. On a Saturday, you know, the family, we'd all be in the house, and hear this noise, loud noise. And we go to the front, you know, kitchen and all that, to the back stuff, we go up in front of the house and look out. And the noise was people walking to the Moorabbin ground.
Ooh.
With balloons, streamers, footy jumpers, banners. But there were that many people walking, I don't know where they walked from, but they were walking to the Moorabbin Ground. And that made a noise to bring us from the back of the house.
Not from the way.
I don't know whether they walked from St Kilda.
No, they wouldn't still be blowing balloons.
Well, we know they're all mad to build the supporters, but not that mad to walk from St Kilda to Moorabbin.
Well,
we are, because
I just moved from Sydney this morning after the last
And it's sort of fitting, I guess, that you played the Swans last night, so sort of think about the Lake Premiership.
Yeah,
so,
I've got
that
in my mind. The team, we've only won one. It's unbelievable.
By the Barretts and Martin.
Well,
we've
won another one, back against Detroit, but in those games, we were allowed to have a rematch, and
Detroit
won it.
But the one that we won in 1966.
We won't go there.
Well, it was a wonderful game.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks everybody. If there's no more questions.